The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the March 2023 issue of Smithsonian, and we'll begin with an article titled Life Among the Ruins by Margot Rabb. From the ashes of a terrible industrial accident, a wonderful garden is flourishing again. A gray afternoon in winter is not unusually considered the best time to visit a garden, but it's perfect for my first glimpse of this extraordinary place. A battered sign reads, "Positively no admittance." Paul Orpello, my guide, opens a creaky gate and leads me into a landscape of ruins, which was largely abandoned for more than 50 years and is now being brought back to life. I realize that garden isn't the right word for it. It feels more like a magical lost city that was bombed in a war. Orpello guides me past murky former swimming pools that now hold snakes and sludge. We sidestep sinkholes and rubber piles. We pass a terrace of cracked columns and crumbling brick walls with hidden recesses like tiny witches' caves. Despite being buried under weeds for decades, a swan mosaic is almost perfectly intact. This may be the strangest garden in America, at once the darkest and most joyous, unlike any other place I've been. Orpello tells me that what he's experienced in this garden changed his life. Walking these paths evokes even more powerful feelings after one learns the landscape's poignant history. For over a century, the DuPont family operated a black powder mill here in Wilmington, Delaware, where more than 300 workers combined saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur to create the explosive powder used in mining and construction and munitions during wartime. It was dangerous work, and during the years that the mills operated, from 1802 to 1921, there were 288 accidental blasts, which killed 228 people, mainly workers. The most powerful came on a foggy afternoon in October 1890, when over 100,000 pounds of black powder detonated, collapsing seven buildings. The shocks were felt as far away as Philadelphia. 12 people died. The DuPont family also lived right on the site, practically on top of the refinery, in a house called Eleutherian Mills. Louise DuPont, 13 years old in 1890, lived at another family home, Winterthur, 2 miles away. The explosion broke most of the windows in the Winterthur house and surely terrified her. She would grow up to transform the terrain around Eleutherian Mills into the marvel we see today. The 1890 blast damaged Eleutherian Mills so severely that the DuPont family moved out. After another explosion further wrecked the site in 1920, the company moved its powder operations, establishing sites in New Jersey and elsewhere. Louise's father purchased the home and mill property from the company and gave it to her, and she took possession of the estate in 1923. Here, Louise and her husband, Francis B. Frank Crowninshield, built the only garden in the world that includes fanciful Italianate structures amid industrial refinery ruins, all in a place where so many people died. As the Crowninshields built their garden, the mill's tunnels morphed into lush hidden grottos, foundations became pools, and arches rose from the powder yard's wreckage. Frank lashed the new structures with chains and hammers to make them look more authentically ruined. Throughout the property, Louise planted thousands of flowers, shrubs, and trees. Industrial saltpeter cauldrons were hoisted on pedestals like ornaments. During nighttime parties, Orpello says, Louise had these cauldrons filled with oil and lit on fire. One can imagine the flames dancing on the ruins, transporting revelers to a dark, magical world. Louise's crown and shield, like her garden, is largely forgotten now. But in her day, she was like a magnet. People flocked to her and loved her, the crown and shield's niece, Catherine Hammond, once said. Louise was famous for her extraordinary kindness. In Boca Grande, Florida, where the crown and shield spent their winters, she was called a fairy godmother after she helped build a community center, health clinic, and a school there. Louise also flouted conventions. It was she who introduced us to the delights of skinny dipping, Louise's niece Ruth Lord once wrote. She loved holding parties in her various homes and hosted so many overnight guests that, according to family lore, the beds never cooled off. The garden took more than a decade to create, beginning in 1928, and Louise would continue improving it throughout her life, maintaining this singular place of ruins atop ruins, like the successive layers of Troy. After she died in 1958, the garden fell into disrepair, though the neglect enhanced its fable-like qualities as the newer ruins and the old powder mills became further battered by nature and time. Orpello, the director of gardens and horticulture at the Hagley Museum and Library, a Smithsonian-affiliated museum that showcases U.S. industrial history and oversees the former mill property, arrived to work at Hagley in 2018. In 2019, using controlled burning and a small crew, Orpello began tearing away the 5 feet of stinging nettles and strangling vines that had buried the garden, revealing the entirety of its ruins. Abandoned gardens have enchanted people for generations. The Garden of Ninfa in Italy grows among the ruins of a medieval town where many residents were killed in 1382 during civil wars. The Lost Gardens of Heligan in Cornwall, England, were abandoned after World War I and restoration began in the 1990s. The Naval Cemetery landscape in Brooklyn, New York, was reinvented and opened in 2016 by Thomas Woltz and his firm, Nelson Bird Woltz, as a native plant garden that honors its dead while celebrating life. Nelson Bird Woltz, in turn, has been hired by the Hagley Museum to help develop a plan for restoring and potentially reopening the Crown and Shield Garden to the public. Alone in the garden during the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown, Orpello was staggered by what he saw. That March, hundreds of white leucojum flowers blossomed. In April, bluebells were waving across the hillside in 1,000 shades of blue, pink, lavender, and white. Louise had planted some of these flowers almost a century ago, and many hadn't bloomed for decades. "Usually I don't cry for much, but here I cry often," he says. "Botanically, it's amazing. You'd expect to find some remnant narcissus or hyacinths, but to see the mertensia, erythronium, tulipa, clusania, after being buried without photosynthesis? Usually the rodent population goes bonkers or everything rots. None of that has happened. I've never lost my belief that it is one of the most important and magical gardens in the world," says landscape curator Philip G. Correll, who began a partial restoration effort in the late 1980s. Woltz is similarly enthusiastic. "When I got there and I saw that the ruin of a ruin was an absolute ruin, I realized there's a kind of meta-complexity and philosophical challenge to this project that I feel like our team's careers have been leading up to." There's an irony in the fact that Louise became a founding trustee of the National Trust for Historic Preservation in 1949, And today, its highest award is named after her. Yet the future of her greatest creation is uncertain. There are critical repairs that we desperately want to get done, says Jill McKenzie, executive director of the Hagley Museum. It's such a thing of beauty, even in its disarray right now. I can only imagine the beauty that we will be able to bring back. The cost of securing the ruins and fully restoring the gardens will be at least $26 million. The Hagley Museum has locked down some funding, but still needs benefactors. Each winter, the freeze and thaw cycles destroy the ruins further. Without help, they may soon collapse beyond repair. I can't tell you how much this place has changed me, Arpello says. I even love the weeds. In a matter-of-fact voice, he adds, this place makes me believe in fairy tales. Charles Birnbaum, founder and president of the Cultural Landscape Foundation, a national education and advocacy nonprofit, he's been called the Johnny Appleseed of neglected landscapes, says when he first saw the Crown and Shield Garden, he was gobsmacked. Here we are unlocking and making visible a story that is unknown, the power of plants because they are alive, because of their ephemerality, their witness to events and to people. There are connection to those cultural lifeways in those earlier times. Arpello was right. The garden is a fairy tale, an irreverent and dark tale that does not sugarcoat the place's tragic past. One afternoon, I asked Arpello if I could walk through the garden alone. Suddenly, by myself, I broke down too. I never cried in a garden before. I had fallen in love with other gardens, but those had been pretty and soothing. This place felt as if it were burning my skin off. I imagined a travel guide ranking pieces by how weepy they made you, though I wasn't sure at first why I was crying. It was grief, but also much more than that. It seemed like a thousand feelings all at once. I asked Arpello, why does it make us break down like this? It's broken and whole. It cracks your shell. You can't hold back here, he said. That afternoon in the garden, after I said goodbye to Arpello, I accidentally kneeled on a nettle plant. I tried to wash up the stingers, but that worsened the burning, as if I'd pushed the spikes deeper in. The garden had changed what I thought of as beautiful. It showed me that an abandoned, broken, weedy, dangerous mess could be the most beguiling and enchanted place I'd ever seen. And it changed what I believed about loss, that a place of tragedy needn't be somber or grim, but it could sing with life and roar like a cauldron lit on fire, like a wild party. It could renew your faith in the world. My knee hurt. During the long drive home, it wouldn't stop burning. The thousand-colored bluebells swayed in my mind every mile, waving their ephemeral and everlasting hello. Next, we'll move on to an article titled The Vienna Agent by Katja Sengel. This is from the prologue section, and it's about heroism. The American heiress who risked her life to help people escape the Nazis and pioneer the refugee assistance movement. A terrified bald man stood in front of a Viennese apartment building on a cold evening. It was March 1938, and Nazi Germany had just annexed Austria. An unassuming woman opened the door. Mary, the man whispered. It functioned almost as a password. His name was Manfred Ackermann. A socialist leader as well as a Jew, Ackermann was in danger. He hoped he would be safe with Mary, 36, who had a reputation in the Austrian resistance for helping its members evade Nazis. Inside her apartment, Ackermann and Mary spoke in whispers. Ackermann needed a fake passport and a hiding place until he could escape Austria. Mary assured him she could take care of both. He handed her his photograph, and she took him outside and led him to a different apartment building to hide. The next morning, Mary bought a corset to conceal the papers she planned to have made for Ackermann. She rode a train across the border to Czechoslovakia, where a contact made Ackermann a passport. Back in Vienna the next day, Mary took her usual precaution of disembarking in the city's outskirts and then riding in a series of trams and taxis to avoid being followed, then made her way to Ackerman and secured his safe passage to Venice. Mary was a pseudonym. Her real name was Muriel Gardner, an American heiress in Austria studying psychiatry. But as fascism ramped up in Europe, Gardner assumed a heroic role, helping hundreds of Jews and resistance members escape pre-World War II Austria. The recent reissue of her memoir, codenamed Mary, first published in 1983 by Yale University Press, is giving readers fresh access to a story that has been largely forgotten since the 1977 Oscar-winning film Julia, drawn from a book chapter by Lillian Hellman, widely considered to have been based on Gardner's life. Indeed, Gardner's memoir offers a tale even more audacious than the movie. Between 1934 and 1939, when she left for the United States on the last American ship to leave France after the start of World War II, Gardner arranged clandestine meetings, smuggled goods and passports across borders, and hid resistance members in her home. Gardner also became a notable figure in the new field of psychiatry, a profession that welcomed few women at the time, and even after World War II, she remained a pioneer in refugee resettlement, advancing ideas and actions still practiced today, work for which her granddaughter, Joan Harvey, says Gardner has received little credit. This drive for justice is impressive, especially given the origins of her family's wealth. Her paternal grandfather, Nelson Morris, was the founder of one of the first and largest meat processing firms in Chicago, Morris & Company. Her maternal grandfather, Gustavus Swift, was the founder of the meatpacking firm Swift & Company. The excruciating experience of many Swift workers would help inspire Upton Sinclair's 1906 novel, The Jungle, which exposed the working conditions imposed by the era's barons. When she was 11, Gardner's father died, and Gardner inherited $3 million, roughly $90 million today. Even in her teens, she devoted herself to philanthropy. As a student at Wellesley College in 1921, Gardner chaired a committee that funded individuals and schools in post-World War I Europe who sent touching, often heartbreaking appeals, she writes in the memoir. Gardner replied personally to an impoverished mother of three, sending a note and money. 25 years later, the same woman would write to Gardner again, this time saying she couldn't feed her grandchildren. Gardner, then 45 and living in New Jersey, sent food packages. Toward the end of her literature studies at Oxford, in 1925, Gardner married an American doctor named Harold Abramson. The marriage quickly soured. Abramson blamed Gardner, saying she belonged in a sanitarium, and wrote to Sigmund Freud seeking an appointment for her. The great analyst responded that he was not taking new patients. But Gardner was interested in psychoanalysis for her own reasons. She thought studying it would help her in her planned career as a teacher, and moved to Austria in 1926, hoping Freud would find room for her among his patients. He didn't. Still, the analyst she ended up with, Ruth Mack Brunswick, secured an invitation to tea at Freud's home, where Gardner got to know the Freuds in a less formal setting. Gardner wasn't close with Freud himself, but became good friends with his daughter, Anna. Toward the end of her analysis, Gardner married Julian Gardner, a British musician. They had a daughter, Connie, in 1931, and divorced soon after. The next year, Gardner went on to study psychotherapy at the University of Vienna Medical School, at a time when the practice was still new. Gardner's course of study, as well as her age, 30, and status as a single mother, marked her as a pioneer. In 1934, the fascists took power in Vienna. Watching a funeral procession that February for those who died fighting the fascists, Gardner first felt a sense of hopelessness. As I stood in the Rathausplatz, she writes, pity and despair overwhelmed me. Yet she was moved to action. They could not cancel out the feelings that had been building up within me these past few days. Indignation, anger, and an imperative need to continue the struggle, hopeless though it may be. Soon she had her friends sending strangers in need to her apartment. Some visitors asked for money and help distributing information on behalf of the Social Democrats, a political party that the Austrian fascists had declared illegal because of its resistance to fascist rule. Gardiner rented a second apartment where she hid Joseph Buttinger, the head of the Revolutionary Socialists, a group coordinating the Austrian underground to fight the fascists. By hiding Buttinger and carrying messages between him and exiles in Czechoslovakia, everything needed to keep the group going, she played a considerable role in ensuring the survival of the resistance. Gardiner concealed messages and books delivered to a librarian, who then used invisible ink to conceal the notes and letters she sent to relatives in Czechoslovakia, where many socialist leaders had fled. When the messengers were too dangerous to put on paper, Gardner relayed them in person, taking the train to Brno. Her messaging service worked smoothly for several years, until her librarian contact was arrested in 1937. Gardner continued her work. Then one morning, the Gestapo showed up at the hotel room she was using as a base of operations. I had often pictured, or thought I was picturing, a confrontation with the Gestapo, but the picture was nothing like the reality, she writes. I had not foreseen the physical aspects, my wildly beating heart, the weakness in my knees, nor had I experienced in my imagination the panic that now overwhelmed me. At what turned out to be a routine interview, Gardner recalled feeling immense relief and then eating a large breakfast. A detail that impressed Carol Siegel, the recently retired director of the Freud Museum in London, founded in 1986 with help from Gardner. She died in 1985. It just sort of touched me that it's just a very human response to danger, Siegel says. Gardner's grandson, Hal Harvey, says that such moments, instances of simple sanity amid existential terror, help explain the renewed interest in her story. There's something about an ordinary person doing extraordinary things, he says. The memoir sold out in about a week when it was reissued in September 2021 and is now on its second printing. In the 1970s, Gardner once asked the director of the Documentation Center of Austrian Resistance, a nonpartisan group founded by former members of the resistance, if he knew of any other American women who'd been involved in the underground. He did not. When he asked former resistance workers the same question, the answer always came back the same, only Mary. Gardner's post-war work also saved many lives, but until now, Buttinger has received most of the recognition. After fleeing Europe for New York in 1939, Gardner and Buttinger, now her husband, became key players in the establishment and development of global refugee outreach and resettlement efforts. During the war, Gardner wrote so many affidavits to the American consul in Vienna to support refugees heading to the U.S. that the consul stopped accepting her letters. Together with Buttinger, Gardner successfully lobbied First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt to help arrange emergency visas for around 200 of the most endangered refugees in France, many of them Austrian and German citizens whom the Nazis were hunting. As late as 1948, Gardner was sending monthly food packages to a list of 100 European families. With several colleagues in 1940, Gardner and Buttinger organized what would become the Emergency Rescue Committee, which in 1942 merged with the International Relief Association to become the International Rescue Committee, IRC. In 1945, Gardner spent time in France as the IRC's Western European supervisor. In her 2010 biography of Gardner, Muriel's War, Sheila Eisenberg writes that some Austrians referred to Gardner as their good fairy and considered her and Buttinger to be mythical figures, Aunt Muriel and Uncle Joe. In Vienna, citizens honored Gardner with a square, Muriel Gardner Buttinger Platz, in 1989. It's quite modest, a hidden gem, not unlike its namesake, whose humanitarian work and bold career are finally getting the attention they deserve. Here's another little article that's tagged onto this called Another Form of Aid by Rebecca Warby. Gardner also supported many artists, including the celebrated painter Alice Neal. Though Muriel Gardner was best known for her support of refugees, she also donated millions of dollars over her lifetime to educational and artistic causes. One of her most consequential cultural subsidies was to Alice Neal. From 1964 until Neal's death in 1984, Gardner provided the painter with a stipend of $6,000 a year, about $58,000 today. The two had been introduced by John Rothschild, a businessman and longtime friend of Neal's. Born in Pennsylvania, Neal is considered one of the great 20th century American realist painters. She once called herself a collector of souls. Her expressive portraits, with subjects ranging from ordinary people to luminaries such as Frank O'Hara, demonstrate the artist's sensitive evocation of the human psyche. In a 1978 interview discussing how psychological acumen was her greatest strength, Neal mused, "In the process of painting someone, I reveal not only what shows, but what doesn't show." In 1966, Neal painted a portrait of Gardner at the latter's Upper East Side residence, unusual for Neal, who typically painted her subjects at her own home. Gardner appears forthright and knowing, her gaze steady, as though she's seeing right into the viewer's or perhaps the painter's thoughts. Yet the canvas was never exhibited until last year, when the Belgian gallery Xavier Hufkens mounted a retrospective of Neal's work. Gardner never sought public credit for her patronage of Neal, which came at the moment of increased interest in Neal's work. Gardner's daughter, Connie Harvey, has said that she often learned about her mother's largesse indirectly, when someone would come out of the blue and say, "Your mother paid for my education," or this or that. She wanted no thanks, says Gardner's biography, Sheila Eisenberg. She believed in freedom, the freedom that comes from having the financial security to live one's own best life. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.